see a sailboat.
Another question or comment? Yeah.
I've never asked this question before. I don't want to go home without asking it. You're well acquainted with the work of the 12-step movement.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I can see how the four noble truths can be put into practice. You know, the first step is the craving, and letting go of the craving, and stopping the craving, and then finding a path. You've got 1, 2, 3, 4. Now, but it's a kind of craving when it comes to alcohol and drugs, where you can't actually, well, let me put it this way, the first thing that I can remember is, as a child, wanting more.
Yeah.
Now, it can be applied to, you know, stopping the craving, but not stopping the actual doing it. But when it comes to alcohol and drugs, the craving has to go completely. You see what I'm sort of see where the difference? Well, take food, for instance. You can't stop food forever.
Right.
You can put the 12-step practice to it.
Yeah.
But there has to be a sort of a moderation. I don't feel because I don't have a food problem. But with alcohol and drugs, it has to you stop drinking forever. You stop taking the drugs. Where it's different to dealing with other craving. I mean, craving for sex, for instance, you can moderate it. Well, maybe you can stop it forever, I don't think. But you see, Ross, I'm putting this question in a very sort of complicated way.
No, I appreciate what you're bringing up, and I'm going to kind of approach it slightly tangentially, but I think I'm aimed at what you're getting at. There's a fundamental distinction between liking and wanting. And this distinction is even found in the brain. In other words, if you, in the one chunk of Buddhist psychology, if you will, is this section in the so-called chain of dependent origination that is very well mapped to Western psychology, that moves from what's called contact, which essentially is a stimulus, to feeling, which is not emotion. It's, in Western psychology language, hedonic tone, of pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral. Quick little sidebar. In my own thinking, it's possible probably to entirely deconstruct the social needs and the attaching system of a millimeter-long roundworm to just some combination of avoiding or approaching, right? Some combination of safety and satisfaction needs. But I think when you get to human beings, we're so social, we're so complex, and I think that's also true of many other social animals, especially social mammals, especially primates, that we need to have what's evolved, really, is a meaningfully distinct system in its own right, the attaching system. That's my personal view. Okay. Similarly, although probably more slowly, I think what might be happening is the evolution of a fourth vedana, a fourth feeling tone. That we cannot deconstruct all the hedonic tones of our relational life into merely some combination of pleasant, unpleasant, and neutral. So I think it's interesting to posit the emergence of a fourth feeling tone of, for lack of a better term, that which is heartfelt. So if you think about it, I'm going to go backwards a little bit here. Great. If you think about it, when something's unpleasant, that activates the avoiding harm system. Okay? And then the question becomes, do we stay green or go red? Right? Do we stay responsive or go reactive? Here, when something's pleasant, it activates the approaching reward system. Then the question is, do we stay green or red? I think it's also interesting to imagine that maybe where we are in the evolution of our species, if we become ever more social, if that trend continues, right, that there's actually the emergence of a fourth feeling tone, a fourth hedonic tone, that which is heartfelt, which then tends to activate the attaching to other system. I'm just offering this as a speculation, but it expands, I think, our personal mindfulness He gives us more subtleties and nuances to be aware of. Right? So then the question becomes, the tipping point between second and third noble truth, right? Unpleasant has arisen. It goes contact, feeling, which is the feeling tone, hedonic tone, and then craving, and then clinging, and then dot, 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 suffering. That's kind of the sequence. Where we develop more and more of a shock absorber in our practice is that critical transition between the hedonic tone as pleasant, unpleasant, neutral, and perhaps heartfelt, and going red about it, getting reactive about it, tipping into craving in one form or another about it. That's the critical transition. Clear? Right? That's very powerful, really. And a lot of Buddhist practices to explore that. It's interesting that in the four foundations of mindfulness, probably the primary, you know, practice instruction from, dare I say it, Coach Buddha, you know, he says, four foundations of mindfulness, four establishments. Where do we establish mindfulness? One of the four is establishing mindfulness of the hedonic tone, of the feeling tone, of experience, as pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral, and perhaps also as heartfelt. So the question then becomes, can we be with unpleasant, pleasant, and heartfelt, and neutral are going to keep arising as long as we live? There's no end to that. The critical question is, what's our relationship to the feeling tone? Can we experience the unpleasant without going into fear or anger about it? Can we experience the pleasant without going into addiction or drivenness or chasing or disappointment or frustration about it? Can we experience the heartfelt, let's say, without tipping into jealousy or envy or controlling other people, working them for their narcissistic supplies? You know, they say in LA, you know, two friends are talking, enough about me, how about you? So, what did you think of my movie? Right? See what I mean? That's the key question. And so that goes to the distinction between liking and wanting, or disliking and wanting not. So in the brain, in the nucleus accumbens, which is in the bottom of the basal ganglia, basically, it's also sometimes called the ventral or lower striatum. There are these little nodes that do liking, disliking, wanting, and wanting not. So if you imagine, you can separate liking from wanting. In other words, imagine being in a meal, you just stuff the friends, right? And then they bring out the dessert. Are you kidding? This dessert is amazing. So you have this huge piece, right? And then they say, come on, come on, have another one. You're like, oh my God. Okay. And then you have this other one. And at that point, you are totally satiated. You are absolutely stuffed. And they say, no, come on, have a third slice. They just want to see barf. No, just joking. So, and then, but then they say, they put it on your tongue. They say, come on, let me give you a spoonful. And they ask you, isn't that delicious? You say, yes. They ask you, don't you like it? You say, oh my God, I love it. Then they say, don't you want more? Oh my God, no, I don't want any more. You see, you can decouple. You can separate liking from wanting. Same way you see people in casinos, let's say. They're gambling. They're pulling the slot machine. Or drug addicts. They want the fix. They want the fix. But they don't particularly enjoy the experience. That's why it's said that liking without wanting is heaven. Wanting without liking is hell. Isn't that really powerful? So a lot of what we're trying to do is you're trying to expand the range of stimuli, of pleasant, unpleasant, and heartfelt, in which we like the pleasant, we dislike the unpleasant, that's natural, okay? We have mixed reactions to the heartfelt, but we don't need to tip into wanting, in the problematic sense of wanting. That's really the key. And my own personal notion is that there are several major ways to gradually move into equanimity. This is equanimity. Right. The reaction has arisen. Unpleasant has arisen. Pleasant has arisen. Heartfelt has arisen. Maybe neutral has arisen. The reaction has arisen, but we don't react to that reaction. We shift our relationship to the hedonic tone of experience. Right? And of major ways to practice with this, I think one major way, oddly enough, is to repeatedly internalize the felt sense of safety, satisfaction, connection, peace, contentment, and love, so that we feel resourced inside. And so when the unpleasant or pleasant or heartfelt comes rolling along, we don't get so rattled by it. It's not the only way to practice with this, but I think it's a very powerful way to practice with it. You see what I'm getting at? Pleasant, liking, wanting? Okay, good. Maybe one more person, and then I'm going to move on to other stuff. Yeah.
There's one question about love being a resting state.
Being what?
Love is our resting state.
Yeah.
I just wonder about that, because sometimes love is associated with pain or loss. And then, or are you talking about a very particular definition of love?
Oh, what I mean is, you know, in other words, what's an equilibrium condition? And the resting state of a complex system, like the mind-brain, the resting state of a system characterizes the system more than various out-of-bounds states of disturbance. Okay? Most human beings, with some significant exceptions, but most human beings, when they feel that their basic needs are met for safety and satisfaction and connection, tend to be quite loving. They tend to be pro-social, they tend to be generous, kind toward other people. Not all, right? But it seems like that is innate to us when we're undisturbed. And again, see for yourself what I mean here, but that's what I mean. Okay. And yeah, one more person for sure.
Oh, thank you. I'm a bit worried about never feeling motivated to do anything again.
Is it liking and wanting? Yeah.
A lot of my motivation is a sense of discontentment or
unease. Yeah.
You know, I want to put things right. I want to perfect them, whether it's the world, my children, myself.
Yeah.
So, you know, if I'm feeling content and peaceful and loving, won't I just sort of go on and sit there?
Right. So she brings up a very important question. You know, and there are variations on this. Like, for example, would artists create if they were not miserable and depressed, right? Or what about social justice and social reform? Or just, you know, organizing recovery, right? And it's interesting that Maslow, in his needs hierarchy, the four lower needs, he calls them D needs. They're deficiency needs. They're based on a sense of deficit or service, right? On the other hand, he considers self-actualization a B need, a being need, in which there's not an internal running sense of deficit and disturbance. So I've my own personal reflection on this, and I've thought about this because it's a very real question, is first, I might be motivated to clean my cupboard or write my symphony out of a sense of deficit inside. On the other hand, could I also be motivated to clean my cupboard or write that symphony if I had an already present sense of fullness? And I suspect I could. And in fact, I think people have the experience, not uncommonly, of finding that their flow states are in this zone where they're not disturbed in that zone. They can really give over to what's streaming through, what they're channeling in some sense, coming through, because they're not rattled by fear or frustration or anger or heartache. You know? And then all that said, I think there's no shortage of deficit states in the world. If we're worried about being demotivated, I actually find that, I'll say it like this. I had a friend who was a monk in Thailand for 9 years plus, and I asked him if he met anybody who was enlightened. Okay. I was more naive than I am now. But anyway, he said, well, first off, it's not like in America where you have a white light moment and the next thing you know, you have your own TV show. Right? And then they watch you, they live with you, they see how you are, you know, thick and thin. And so I said, okay, fine. But did you meet anybody who was enlightened? He said, well, there were some people, you know, who were far along, you know, the process. I said, what were they like? He said, well, two things. First, they had a lot of energy. They didn't just sit and do nothing. They wanted to build monasteries, they wanted to offer teachings, they wanted to help people. So they didn't just go into a state of quiescence. I think about people alive in the world today who are, you know, very developed teachers in many different traditions. Judaism, Islam, Christianity, Hinduism, Buddhism, etc. And they're very engaged. They're not just blissed out all the time. They want to help. That's interesting. It goes to the question of resting state. These are people who are really undisturbed, and they're very, you know, generous. The second thing he said was that they were always the same. I said, what do you mean by that? He said, well, I mean, sometimes they were talkative, sometimes they were quiet. Sometimes you could feel they were kind of in a good mood. Other times they were more stern and, you know, abbot-like, what have you. But they were always the same in the sense. If you were nice to them, they really loved you. If you were mean to them, they really loved you. Their love was unconditional. You know, it wasn't based on pleasant, unpleasant, or heartfelt. They were free, in effect, in their relationship to stimuli and their own experience of stimuli. So, okay. So I want to reserve our time.